Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Alex Furlong is about to die. And enter the year 2009, where immortality is only a heartbeat away. Where money can buy anything.
Shouldn't you consider an alternative body?
Sorry to deceive you. Including life itself.
Why me? Why don't they just grab somebody who's alive now?
Take a look at these people, Alex. They've lived half their lives with no ozone layer.
Tell me who's behind all this.
I'm sorry. But I can't tell you that.
Alex, don't you remember me?
He died, Jewel. Someone paid to bring him back.
I watched you die.
Welcome to my mind. Don't resist.
Lose your mind, and you can live forever. Free Jack.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm Mike White. Joining me is my co-host, Rob St. Mary.
You can take my body, but you'll never take my mind.
I might take you up on that. And our old friend, Fred Fritz of the Movie Apocalypse.
I wouldn't mind if you took my body, actually.
Just depends on where I take it. All the way to Poughkeepsie. This week, we're looking at the 1992 sci-fi epic, Free Jack. Directed by Jeff Murphy, Free Jack is the tale of Alex Furlong, a race car driver who, at the moment of his death, gets zapped into the future of 2009. It's a scary time when the hijacking of human bodies is something of a common practice, at least for the rich. Alex escapes, thus becoming known as a Free Jack. He looks up his old friend Brad and his girlfriend Julie, all the while he's pursued by the ruthless bone jacker Vasendak. He's pretty much used as a pawn in a power struggle at the McCandless Corporation. Got that? Good. All right, Rob, I know that Free Jack was one of the few films that I've inflicted on you recently. Give it to me straight. What did you think of the film?
You know, I have to say, I really love this film because it's a very beautiful story between a boy and a whale that features a beautiful song by Michael Jackson. It's just a heartbreaking tale.
Rob, I think that's Free Willy you're talking about, not Free Jack.
I watched the wrong movie. I'm sorry.
Oh, jeez.
But serious, this one, you know what the issue is for me with this, and I know we're going to get into it, is that to me, it's too antiseptic for the future. It's trying to be dystopian, but to me, it looks too clean. It's sort of the same issue with Total Recall. Well, I really like Total Recall, but at times it looks kind of too antiseptic. And almost when I was watching it, I kind of felt like this was shot with the same film stock as Total Recall. It has that same kind of gloss. The future is kind of too clean. Even when it's dirty, it's too clean.
All right. I like that Manhattan is very clean, but outside of Manhattan, I think it's a lot more dirty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I don't know if that necessarily always comes through the has versus the have nots. I do like that there is a little bit of a line that there's the rich and the poor and there's nothing in between. You know, I guess that some things in 2009 or 2012 kind of are coming true. We're not necessarily bone jacking people or making free jacks, but there are some things coming out of that. First off, we should probably say that the film was directed by Jeff Murphy, who had just directed Young Guns in 1990, and Billy the Kid himself, Emilio Estevez, he's the guy that plays Alex Furlong, kind of bringing along his manic intensity. He's kind of like Charlie Sheen without the coke, but he's very animated in this one. And then I love the supporting cast. You've got Rene Russo as Julie, the girlfriend. And then one of my all-time favorite castings, I'm not even talking about McCandless himself. I'm talking about the supporting characters of Vasendak, played by Mick Jagger, and talking about Brad being played by one David Johansen, a.k.a. Buster Poindexter. This is the movie where the New York Dolls met the Rolling Stones. I love it.
That's good. I really like that because, to me, those two are great. And then I don't know if you notice this as well, but you actually get a twofer at this time in Mick Jagger history, if you know anything about Mick. You get Jerry Hall, his then-wife, as the reporter in the bar scene. So there you go. There's another extra thing for all you Rolling Stones crazy people out there.
Yeah, and then we won't even go into, well, I guess we probably will, Anthony Hopkins as McCandless. This movie came out in January of 1992, and I want to say that this is right around the time that he's being nominated for Oscars for his role as Hannibal Lecter. So not doing too bad, and then he shows up in Free Jack, kind of took a lot of people by surprise.
When I saw the film, I really enjoyed it. It's a very flawed movie, but the cast is the winning aspect of the film. If you're going to walk away with anything good from the movie, it's the cast. I'm a huge fan of actor Jonathan Banks, who unfortunately has next to nothing in this movie, sadly. But I grew up with him on Wise Guy, and I'm so happy to see he's back again currently stealing the show on Breaking Bad. A lot of people were making fun of Mick Jagger and Free Jack. I actually thought he was a lot of fun.
I thought he was great. I love every time that he's on screen, especially when he says Alex Furlong's name. There's just something about that.
I have to agree. And why we didn't get a scene of him and Buster Poindexter together.
I know.
So many missed opportunities. I'll tell you what, that's how I really look at this movie, is just one giant missed opportunity after another. There's like all these great raw pieces, you know, they just never come together.
One of my favorite scenes in Rio Bravo is when you got Dean Martin and Ricky Nelson on screen at the same time. They got to do a song together. That's so great. If Mick and Buster had somehow found a way to bust out a tune, you know, maybe they're at the karaoke bar chasing down Furlong, you know, stop and sing a little song, guys. Come on. I mean, if Mick Jagger can do that horrible dancing in the streets with David Bowie, he can do something with Buster Poindexter. Come on. It would get me hot, hot, hot. Even the smallest roles in this thing. I mean, you've got Amanda Plummer playing a nun. You got Frankie Faison playing a homeless guy.
Yeah, I mean, Amanda Plummer's just great. She's this wisecracking nun who's got like some of the best like quotable lines in the film. Almost kind of reminds me of what became of Cheech Marin's character in Machete, the trailer, and then the film. You know, just this sort of like, okay, I'm a person of the cloth, I guess, but I got guns and I'm going to swear a lot, so it's fun. But Frankie Faison actually is a face that most people probably know. He was Barney the guard in Silence of the Lambs, who takes Clarice down to see Dr. Lecter. And he's great. He just shows up in all these different places in all these films. He's been around like forever. He used to have a TV show like years ago. I was just like really happy to see him and wish that he had more to do than just one role where he offers Emilio something really bad to eat. But that one that one scene is really good because he's just so much fun to watch. And he's part of the troop of people that I often joke about, you know, could read the back of the cereal box and make it compelling. So he's, for me, he's one of those guys who's underappreciated as a small character actor. Most people don't know him by name and know him by face.
Yeah, whenever I see him, I'm always like, oh, hey, it's Barney. Just kind of like whenever I see Grandel Bush, the guy that played Julie's bodyguard in this, I'm always like, oh, it's Agent Johnson. No, the other one.
Yeah, it's, you know, I got to agree with you on this, Fred. There's so many like little great parts and really nice scenes and, you know, stuff like that. But it just, it's kind of like trying to make Jell-O. You ever make like Jell-O and you put too much water in it, it just kind of like leaks out all over the place. It doesn't kind of form. It's kind of the same thing with this, where I think Free Jack has a lot of really good stuff in there, but it doesn't want to mold for some reason.
I was really looking forward to this movie for two reasons. First of all, I had loved Young Guns 2. I thought it was a very entertaining piece of pulp. It's not deep or anything, but it's extremely entertaining. And I also enjoyed his science fiction film that he had done years before called The Quiet Earth. I really liked that one. So when I heard about Free Jack, and I was like, oh, Emilio Estevez, they had done Young Guns 2 together. It's science fiction. It deals in time travel or time displacement, maybe is even a better way of wording it, just like The Quiet Earth. I thought, this is interesting. This is some pretty cool little facets all coming together. And the sad thing is that these facets never meet. And there's all these little tiny, even there's camera mistakes, you know, little tiny errors throughout the film. But yet it's still entertaining to watch, though.
Yeah, I'm not the kind of guy who gets an erection over any kind of continuity errors. You know, I'm very forgiving of that kind of stuff. But this one's got a continuity error that is so noticeable to me that it just like pops out every time I watch it, which is Julie and Alex, before they go into, you know, Alex's race car driver and he's going in to meet some of the sponsors. And before they go in, Julie's got her hair pulled back, cut short in the front, not too long in the back. And then he comes out, he goes to get in the race car. She's got a hat on now and her hair is like twice as long as it was before. I'm like, okay, I wonder if this was done in reshoots or something. So, but it was just really strange.
I was just going to say, the one that actually bothered me was, because it's one of those things you can clearly tell it's just the shot continued from prior, is right before they actually jack Emilio Estevez and Mick Jagger is on the top of the tank with the helmet on. And then he casually walks into the science bay where they're going to steal the body. And then after they get the body, now he's back up on top of the tank with the helmet on. We're talking like seconds. We're talking seconds later.
I think you underestimate his sneakiness.
The power of the Jagger.
The one thing that made me laugh really hard is actually in the beginning. I don't want to call this a continuity error, but I think this is, might be like an error of character development in a way. They're soon-to-be married couple, and they high-five each other. How many married couples or soon-to-be married couples high five each other? Come on.
There is a point of contention about that, though, that he wants to get married. She doesn't. That is part of the plot point. They talk about that at the beginning.
Then there's this wild sexual passion with the nibble my ear bit.
Well, you know, they could fist bump like Michelle and Barack Obama, but they weren't terrorists. I think in the script, at least one of the scripts, and I know we'll talk about this a little bit later, that it's the opposite, where it's Julie says that she loves Alex, but Alex won't say that he loves her back. The amount of time that goes by, 18 years, they don't really do a whole lot to age people in this movie. Brad looks pretty much like Brad, just with like his hair down instead of back. And then Julie, to me, looks exactly the same. But it's kind of weird that, you know, you could go 18 years in the future in one, you know, in a heartbeat kind of thing. And I don't know, I guess some of the stress on the relationship comes out because Alex is constantly accusing her of two-timing him. I mean, he gets screwed over by Brad, but then he's like always on Julie's case, like, oh, what are you doing? You told McCandless about me. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And it's like, dude, relax. You know, not everybody's out to get you kind of thing, even though they are all out to get him. But other than Brad and then Vasendik being constantly after him, nobody is like, oh, hey, it's that guy. Let's chase him down. You know, there's no like freelance people out there just like, oh, hey, it's that Freejack. Let's go get him.
One of the things I noticed rewatching the movie, it's interesting that he doesn't really seem like he's gone so much into the future of his world, but an alternate reality. Because 18 years is not a long time, as we know. I mean, comparatively speaking, Mick Jagger was not young. He would have been from Emilio's time. He might have even watched that race on TV when Emilio died. Same with everybody, Anthony Hopkins. But they all seem like people from that time period. None of them seem like they were in Alex's time at all. They all seem like they were just instantly like, you know, sea monkeys. You know, somebody poured them in and boom, it was 2009 soup. That's probably my biggest problem with the movie, is that there's no sense of flow. 18 years is not enough time. The relationship between Emilio and Rene Russo's character, it's pointless in the film. It is ultimately pointless in the film almost completely.
Well, it's a flawed plan to me that, and we're going to get into spoilers in this one, so I'm just going to put that out there right now. If you haven't seen the film since 1992, you know, I'm sorry, but you should have already seen this movie. McCandless, Anthony Hopkins, bringing Alex forward into the future 18 years so that he can then get into Alex's body after he has died and then somehow woo Julie. What was he thinking? There's no way. It's like he would show up at work one day and be like, Jules, I took Alex's body. We're now together. We can now be fated. It's like he is completely off his rocker if he thinks that that's the way that he's going to get this chick. Buy her some flowers, dude. Don't steal the body of her dead boyfriend.
You know, the other thing with this, and I think this is probably part of the reason why I brought up Total Recall, is the fact that their relationship setup in the beginning is so sort of superficial and lame that it reminds me of the setup between Arnold and Sharon Stone in Total Recall, where we really don't get much. It's just sort of like, oh, they're together. Isn't that nice? And it's just sort of, eh. It's kind of – it's really oatmeal. There's really nothing special.
I agree.
And I think that's why it doesn't pay off in the end. It's sort of like you're breathing the same oxygen, and yeah, you kind of touch each other. But beyond that, it's like, come on. Is there anything else?
Well, you have three characters that all come from the previous time period when Alex dies. And that's, of course, I'll just say Buster Poindexter, and Renee Russo and Emilio Estevez's character. Those three are the only three that have any kind of carryover. And it's only been 18 years, and you, of course, see the betrayal coming from David, you know, from a mile away. It's not a surprise. And the Renee Russo, yeah, they're going to fall back in love, no surprise. Everything is ridiculously generic. It's like Rob just said, there's nothing to kind of latch on to. I mean, if Brad's character had been, say, Amir's brother, you know, as well as his promoter, that could have added a little edge there. You know what I mean? So, like, he finds his brother. Oh, my gosh, what's going on? And then he betrays him. Then you would kind of go, oh, I understand Alex's paranoia. I mean, if he can't even trust somebody like his own brother, for instance, you know, in this future world, whatever has changed, then all rules are off. You know what I mean? You just – anybody can be after you. Then his paranoia towards Julia would be a little bit more solid and a little bit more understandable. But we never understand anything about Julia anyway.
And yeah, she could have just as very well have been a plant from McCandless, just the way that Sharon Stone was a plant from Cohagen.
And 18 years is, again, the whole idea of bonejacking is even weird, because 18 years, look at the internet over 10 years. Think of this concept of being able to steal a body out of time. It's just not enough time. That's all it is.
One of the problems I also had was when he's running around before it's explained what a free jack is, that he goes back to the old apartment and there's a couple that's living there. And one of them freaks out and is like, he's a free jack and all this. And it's like, there's really no explanation as to how the average person in the society would know this.
How many of these guys break away?
Yeah. And the thing is, it's like, it seems like it would be such an elite thing that it would be a code word or something among really hyper rich people. These poor black folks who are living now in this ghetto neighborhood where he used to live, how the hell would they know what a free jack is? So that was another thing that bothered me.
Unless it was a way for them to make money. We have a free jack on the loose. You can collect $10 million or 15, whatever the rate is going now. Get this guy. You would think that there would be more people. Like, you would think that guy has a gun at the door. You'd think he'd be like, oh, sure, come on in. You know, let's anybody that comes to your door that has some sort of memory loss, you would think they'd just be like, oh, hey, it's a free jack. Come on in. That's a free jack and a free meal. And I do have to say that's kind of a fatal flaw to this movie as well, is just the name of the movie. Because, I mean, really, it kind of sounds a little dirty and a little silly at the same time. And especially, so you got Free Jack and then you got the Bone Jackers that are coming after him. They really should have rethought that.
I guess I don't mind the idea of Free Jack by itself. But yeah, when you add Bone Jacker in and like everything's got Jack after it, and then, you know, the spiritual switchboard even has a giant Jack for literally zero reason. They're using Jack as, you know, as in to steal or heist or take, or that has absolutely nothing to do with the spinning of a Jack. You know, I mean, when I think of a free Jack, that's kind of what the idea sounds like to me, is like something that's balancing, but it's spinning in every direction. I don't mind the title, but when you start adding all those other...
I'm not 100% sure, but I think what they were trying to do was sell the concept to Jack in the Box as a tie-in, so that way they would constantly have Jack, Jack, Jack all the time, and then there you go. See? Product placement. They were ahead of their time. They just couldn't get that deal to go through, so that's why it ended up the way it was. They didn't bother to fix the script.
Yeah, because they originally were supposed to go to the Jack in the Box in the future, and that's where that whole restaurant scene was going to take place, but didn't work out. It was kind of like Taco Bell's product placement in Demolition Man.
And I don't know if you guys noticed this, but this movie is such a RoboCop wannabe, right down to the two businessmen in an elevator shot talking about their boss. you know, with that absolutely hideous blue screen work that this movie has some of the worst I've ever seen.
Oh my God. Yeah, it is terrible.
I can't believe how bad it is.
And it's all blue screen for no reason to be blue screen. Like, you're in an elevator. How hard is that to shoot?
I was in shock when I was watching. I was like, is this for real? There's shots, the shots on the bridge. There are shots where you're like, okay, that does not have to be blue screen. That absolutely does not have to be blue screen.
Well, since they spent all the money on the cast, they had to go to the local public access in order to get the blue screen done.
It just felt like it was like a quilt. You know what I mean? It was patched together. It's like when you look at the book and you look at the movie, you're like, seriously, you didn't even have to buy the rights to this thing. This is not Immortality Inc. outside of the word spiritual switchboard and a few minor concepts, but it's quilted together. And as I was watching, I was going, this stuff with corporate America feels like it's right out of RoboCop. Like they just sort of stuck it in there. The stuff with Michelette, the Jonathan Banks character, his character makes almost no sense. Yeah, he wants to steal the company, and well, that's it. That's his big thing.
Well, it almost would have worked a little bit nicer had they used those commercial breaks like they did in Total Recall and in RoboCop to kind of help explain things a little bit more and kind of immerse you a little bit more into this world.
Right.
As he's looking from across the river over to Manhattan, you can see those big billboards and everything. And I'm like, oh, wow, I would like to see what those say. You know, and I know that they're talking about the suicide booths. I can see the word suicide on them, but that's the only time you get that. And that's a concept that people aren't going to get unless they've read the book. And you can barely see it on screen. I mean, watching this on video, forget it. There's no way. I mean, until the Blu-ray comes out, which I pray that it does any day now. But yeah, this thing is it. You're not going to see that stuff. The other thing I wanted to say really quick, as far as we were talking about technical stuff, was, you know, I'm a big fan of sound effects, and I'm always listening for the Wilhelm in movies, and there's a few sound effects where whenever I hear them, I have to laugh because I've, you know, used them in the past, or they just always kind of, you know, strike me as very familiar, like especially like this one very particular electricity noise that I've heard a million times before. But in this one, there's like this James Brown scream that happens.
I know the one you're talking about.
At least three times in it. And, you know, it's always like, oh, yeah, they're having a big chase or whatever. And then they just throw in this James Brown scream. And it's like, what the heck, guys? Couldn't you find a different sound effect in the library? You know, why does it have to be this one over and over and over again?
Well, the thing that's funny about that is it totally calls attention to itself. It's like they want you to know that's exactly what you heard. It's so sort of out front. It's incredible.
I think they might have been trying to intentionally camp it up a little at that point when they got it to the, you know, the finished edit and that, and they're looking at it going, okay, anything can be an improvement at this point. If you want to talk, for me, the most solid thing in the film, the actual real relationship in the movie is actually between Vicindic and Furlong. In fact, it's the best part of the movie overall. There's kind of a fun interplay between them, and I wish there had been actually more of that. But, you know, the movie is what it is, and we can't wish it into existence. But there is no doubt that if you want to talk about a relationship in the film, again, proving that Julie was really almost useless in the story. She really was. I hate to be mean because I like Rene Russo. It has nothing to do with her. She serves no purpose other than to be the destination.
Yeah, no, I love the scene of Alex escaping, and he's got that video screen, and you've got him kind of taunting Vicendak, and Vicendak taunting right back, and just that whole scene is great. I love that.
Yeah, although it does have Jagger's worst delivered line, though. Even though it's a funny line, is, oh no, I'm afraid of the dog.
This,
but you're speeding.
Where are we going? Oh no, I hate the dark.
Piss off.
You can't get rid of me that easily.
What? No applause?
The show's not over yet.
Box him in and run him down. But be gentle. I want him without a scratch.
You should stop.
Imagine how upset we'd both be if you were hurt.
Oh, imagine. Come on, Mesendik. You couldn't catch a cold. You couldn't catch the clap if you were in a whorehouse. What? Holy shit! How am I doing?
Not bad.
Breaks the pedal on the left. The game's over for a long. Don't do it. Don't do it!
I have to say that the way they have Alex in the story, his cockiness, is actually a better asset than the character of Blaine from the book, because you got to think about how this character could possibly survive. And Alex's cockiness, his living on the edge as a race car driver, his, you know, sort of devil may care attitude, if you will, that explains how he could kind of survive. And that's what makes it so cool. And that's why Vicendek is sort of like, I hate using the term, but is opposite number in this world. And so these two characters really, they fit perfectly. It's just the rest of the movie that doesn't fit so perfectly.
If you want to see Mick Jagger as an actor, Ned Kelly, no. Performance, no. All about this one. It's all about the Free Jack.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a few with more on Free Jack here on the Projection Booth.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at AdamandEve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOTH at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out AdamandEve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at AdamandEve.com.
Hi, my name is Shane.
And I'm Monica.
And we are the two people.
We can't say anything.
Oh.
Because they're going to censor us.
Is that the thing we signed?
Yeah.
We can't
say anything.
No bad words. No. So we can't tell them about our show.
No.
We can't actually tell them anything about what we do.
No.
Wow. That's really weird. Okay. Well, hi, I'm Shane.
I'm Monica.
And
rantmehard.com.
That's all. Rantmehard.com. Go there and find out, because we can't.
I can't believe we signed that thing.
Ahoy, mateys. This is K.A.B., Antonio Bay. Stevie Wayne here, beaming a signal across the sea. I'll be here playing music all through the witching hour. I'm still waiting to hear from that weatherman. But in the meantime, stay here with me. Be sure to visit our sponsor, Paracinema Magazine. They're the source for all your genre movie needs. Check them out online at paracinema.net. Tell them Stevie sent you. Keep me turned on for a while, and I'll do my best to do the same for you.
The smooth sound. Fabulous 1340. KAB.
It follows.net.
All right, we're back. We're talking about Free Jack. In a time travel movie, it's only appropriate that we go back in time a little bit. Let's head back to 1958 and talk about Robert Sheckley's novel, Immortality, Inc. This book is credited as the source for Free Jack. To call it a loose adaptation might even be stretching that. So, Fred, I know you read Immortality, Inc. What were your thoughts on Sheckley's story?
First of all, they hijack his mind, not a body, in this story. So there's a really huge difference. It's interesting because as you read it, it's like at first I was drawn in for about the first quarter. But there's these bizarre moments that kept pulling me out, like when the character of Blaine, who is the main character, not Furlong, walks out of the corporation that has brought him there. And he's in a completely different body, and he walks out into the world, and he's describing everything he sees, and he sees smaller cars, but he sees clearly that air traffic now exists, including sky cabs and like jump helicopters and things. And then after this observation, he talks about a mall. I think he says it's up on the 20th floor, and goes, "How do they get up there?" Well, maybe in the sky cabs you've just been describing for the last page. So there's very sloppy writing. I have to say, I was kind of surprised by that. But overall, I'm just going to say it direct. I think the book's a mess. Seriously, it's like about 10 different science fiction stories all duking it out for supremacy. Seriously, you could spin off so many different movies from this one book.
He kind of totally did spin off at least all the ideas. This was his first book, and this was kind of his, like, his Rosetta Stone, really, when you look at it, because he would pick up these themes, like that whole, the last section where we have Blaine's mind going from where it's at in the U.S. all the way over to the Marquesas. He's going from one mind to another, to another, to another. There was a whole book that he did that was basically mind swapping. And it's like, okay, so he's all about that. Then you've got that kind of weird break where Blaine is trying to find a job. He doesn't really know what he's going to do in the world, and he becomes a hunter of people, and it turns into this whole most dangerous game thing. That was one of Sheckley's big obsessions. I mean, he's the guy that wrote The Tenth Victim, which became the movie of the same name, and then he wrote The Prize of Peril, which was adapted for Das Millionspiel, which I've talked about a bunch, and Le Prix du Danger, which was, again, kind of this was kind of a Running Man progenitor. I always say that the movie of the Running Man was far more close to these movies than it was to the Stephen King story or Richard Bachman story. So it's kind of, we're kind of going back to our old discussions that Rob and I have had about, you know, people hunting people movies, you know. So his whole work kind of really goes into that whole, you know, Punishment Park, Battle Royale, Series 7 kind of a world. So, but yeah, he, like, that's what, 14 pages in the book, but then he spins it out into The Tenth Victim, Hunter Victim, all these different stories. And yeah, it just feels a little bit tacked on, to say the least. And then, yeah, you've got the whole zombie story going on. It's really kind of strange that they bring his brain forward, put it in another body as a publicity stunt, basically. And then they have this old man who runs the company, the Rex Corp. He's going to die and go into a new body, but it's not this one. It's a different body. But then he never succeeds to make it in, but another spirit comes in and takes over that body. And I think it's a lot more our problems that we were having with this seeming to be a very limited thing, this whole freejacking thing. It's so common in the new world, in this world of 152 years in the future rather than 18 years in the future.
Oh, gosh, I swear we could do another episode on this book alone, to be honest. It's got so many contradictory thoughts in it. In fact, I don't know if you heard, because I know for a fact you know about the British equivalent of Outer Limits, Out of the Unknown. And they adapted Immortality, Inc. into an episode, which, by the way, you can't find. It doesn't exist. It, like the Doctor Who episodes of that period, they erased it foolishly. But whatever. What's interesting is there's an actual – you can find this on YouTube. There's a tape of George Harrison and Ringo Starr talking about it. You can tell that they also thought just that episode was very convoluted and contradictory. And if you go point by point and you put it all together, you know, and you do one of those like paranoid walls with the with the string, you know, and the thumbtacks, and by the end, you know, you might be able to, like, you know, freak out your neighbors a little bit, but you're not going to end up with a better understanding of that story, because there's no reason for them to pull him into the future as a publicity stunt, because the book then later on clearly states people have been pulled out of the past multiple times. When he goes look for a job, they make that clear, even though the man he goes to visit is a charlatan, again, is a point that goes nowhere in the story. But there were other people pulled out of the past There's no point to this man being pulled. There is literally no point. I mean, at least Freejack has something in its favor. They're pulling a body out of the past because it's healthier. Ironically, have you ever seen a movie called Millennium?
Oh, yeah. I just rewatched that recently.
There's my one of my favorite underappreciated science fiction films because I've read the book and seen the movie. The funny thing is that movie is actually closer to Immortality, Inc. than Freejack, because you have this idea of going back in time, stealing healthy bodies in the hope of a better future. I'm boiling it down, of course, because I don't want to describe the entire plot to Millennium. But the book just – it goes nowhere by the end of the book. And then they start throwing in these last-minute weirdnesses about when Blaine was in the car wreck. It turns out he was murdered because the car was taken over. So they literally went out of their way to even get this body. And then at the last – literally the last two pages, they throw in – no, I'm the murderer because I gained control of the wheel for a quarter of a second and I wanted to crash anyway. I'm just going, oh, heaven, save me from this book.
You guys have read the book, and Mike, you've gone over some of the screenplays. I haven't. To you, and maybe you know this, maybe you don't, or maybe you can at least even theorize why this would be the case. If this book is so crazy and so convoluted and doesn't really make a lot of sense, why even try to make a film out of it? I mean, is the author so sort of like well-known that they just bought everything that he happened to write? So therefore it was like, oh, we got all these properties. We got to make a film out of it. I mean, what do you know about sort of how this book became a script and then a film? I mean, why do it?
I really wish I knew. I mean, this kind of takes us to the point where I say that I have reached out to everyone that I could possibly find when it came to Freejack. I mean, of course, you know, I reached out to Emilio and Mick and all these people, Hopkins, all these folks. But really, the ones that I was hoping to get were Jeff Murphy, who wrote me an email and just said, hey, I hear you're trying to find me. And I wrote back and I was like, yeah, this is great. Hey. And I didn't even say Freejack. I said, hey, we're going to do an episode on the Quiet Earth because I love the Quiet Earth as well. We're going to do an episode on the Quiet Earth. And I planned on, if we got them, that I would just sneak those Freejack questions in there. Never heard anything back from them. And then I talked to Stephen Pressfield, who is a very successful author. I talked to him, I think this was last November, and I was like, hey, you know, are you the same? Because nowhere on his website does it say Freejack. And I was like, are you the same Stephen Pressfield that wrote Freejack? He's like, yeah, but I don't like to talk about that. And so I asked him if he would come on the show, and he was just like, no, I don't want to talk about that at all. And like, I even went back to him a few months later. I was like, have you reconsidered? No, I will not talk about it. I mean, he was being nice about it, but he would not talk about it. And then Ron Shushit reached out to him. I got his wife's contact information because she kind of handles his business affairs a lot of the time. We kept going back and forth, and we have been playing email tag since November of last year. As we're recording this, we are just about to June of 2012. So we have been playing tag for 7 months now, and it is like every few months I'll reach out and she'll be like, oh, yeah, yeah, this is great. Let's talk this week. Give me, you know, drop me an email on Friday. And I'm like, every time I'm like, why don't you just call me? Here's my number. You know, let's talk. What's your number? Why don't we just talk? Let's set something up. How about this day? How about this time? Does that work for you? Nothing. So it has just been, oh, it's been so frustrating because I would love to know, long-winded answer over, I would love to know, why does it say so prominently at the beginning, based on the book Immortality, Inc. by Robert Sheckley? Because, yeah, other than a few very loose, fleeting ideas, Harlan Ellison would be hard-pressed to sue about this movie if he wrote Immortality, Inc., and that's saying something.
I have a slight theory that I've already kind of touched upon, but I really think that there's a lot of truth, and if you follow the breadcrumbs, it does lead to it. And it goes back to RoboCop. RoboCop is 1987, and I'm looking at the copy of the screenplays that they wrote, which was one was 88 and one was 90. And the one thing in the book that I did notice is the book has this very morbid sense of humor about society. And there is some legitimately funny moments if you have a very pitch black sense of humor. There is commentary that would seem like it came out of the world that RoboCop was set in. I really think that what you have here is RoboCop hits in 87. It shocks everybody, you know, because as we all know, nobody wanted to do RoboCop. All right. That was the movie that happened by accident. And this movie hits. Nobody sees it coming. And they want to get something out there that has that feel, that has that style. You know, we want to make it action. We want to be set in the future. We want it to be satirical with that same dark sensibility. And think about it, Free Jack does have all those raw pieces. And like I said, there's even those elements in Free Jack. If you really, seriously, the whole corporate thing in the last half of the movie felt like RoboCop to me. Like out of nowhere, there's just these shots of Jonathan Banks and this other guy who like disappears halfway through the movie, his right-hand man. And, you know, they're talking about the old man upstairs, and there's this whole corporate intrigue about taking over the corporate and rising the corporate ladder. And I really do think they were trying to make a RoboCop.
It's funny that we've brought up RoboCop because they were shooting this thing in April of 1991, and I read some accounts of Atlanta being, you know, transformed into this futuristic world and all this kind of stuff. It looked like Atlanta, basically. And what else was shooting at the exact same time was RoboCop 3. I think more than RoboCop, you kind of got more of a RoboCop 3 out of this film.
Well, I would agree with that. But I do honestly think that what you have here is you have a lot of hands, you know, saying, hey, we should have something like this from this other movie. And I mean, there's even a shot in the film. Do you guys remember when Emilio is in the restaurant with David and there's a guy who says, "You keep staring at me, you're going to die," because he pulls out a gun. And Emilio's wearing this ugly bowler hat. And he looks down, pulls out the gun, looks up with a cocky smile. That exact shot's in Young Guns 2. And this whole movie feels like a patchwork. It just feels like a patchwork of a million different movies.
It's funny because I think you said almost the same thing about the book. So in that way, the two things are so similar is that they're just kind of these hodgepodge of ideas.
They are. That's the point. That you're seeing a book that's really just a lot of ideas. And then you could see a screenplay writing going, hey, I could really make something from this. And in the end, is it soup yet?
Boy, we have a lot of food metaphors on this episode between soup and Jello and oatmeal. I mean, this is making me hungry. Let me go back. I was the one who subjected myself to the screenplays. And I have to say that actually finding the screenplays for this movie was pretty darn hard. The first one that I got my hands on was from July 18th, 1988. And there are a lot of the same kind of touch points as we get in the final film, but so I'll just highlight some of the differences. First one is that Vasendek is much more dangerous. When Alex gets a ride from a cab driver at the beginning, which we see in the final film, he runs off. The cab driver is there with all the bone jackers, and he is just completely apologetic. "I'm sorry, I didn't know who the guy was, da 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 da." Vasendek just pulls out a gun and blows the guy away. And that's kind of Alex's first real look at, because he kind of turns and sees this, Alex's first look at how vicious this world can be. So Vasendek, after that first murder, is pretty much irredeemable. So you don't get that playful discussion. You don't get that great relationship between the two characters, and he ends up getting killed at the end, and you're very happy that he gets killed at the end. In this one, rather than using live ammunition, they use these guns that they call lobo guns, so lobotomy guns. And it's kind of the same thing too. He goes to a bar. Rather than Jerry Hall being there, it was supposed to be at one point Vincent Schiavelli was going to be there as a insurance salesman, which kind of ties a little bit more back to the book, the whole hereafter insurance kind of stuff, where if you get killed, you will for sure go on to the afterlife, or if someone, you know, takes over your body, you will go on to the afterlife. They really drop that whole thing from the final film. And the insurance salesman gives him a lobotomy pen. And then, of course, you know, it's one of those, like, here you go, page 45, he gets the lobotomy pen. You know, at page 110, he's going to be using that pen at the very crucial moment. And sure enough, that's what happens to it. Also, just going on Vasendek a little bit, I found it very funny the way they described him in the screenplay. First off, he drives a hearse around, and he has little baby shoes hanging from the rearview mirror. I was like, oh, okay, that kind of reminds me of Raising Arizona a little bit. And they describe him as looking like a cross between the Predator and an Armani model.
That's the worst description I think I've ever heard.
There's kind of the same idea of Furlong not killing of Sendek is there, but in this case, they're actually after a Freejack together at the same time. There is a Freejack who comes back, or comes forward, I should say, from the past, and he goes insane, breaks out. So again, you're kind of getting that there are other Freejacks out in the world, and all of these like random bounty hunters, Bonejackers, are out on the streets, and they Shanghai Furlong and anybody else who's out there at this time and make him help them hunt this guy down. They give him a weapon, they give him a helmet, and so when he saves Vasendek's life, he doesn't know who it was that saved his life, and he says, you know, oh, give this man the highest honor, and the way that he talks suddenly shifts to like this like medieval tone. It's really kind of strange. And, you know, what can I do for you as a token of my appreciation? And that's when he asks for a name. And they kind of kept that idea when they went forward with another draft. So let me just, I'll keep rambling for a little bit. Next draft that I found online was September 18th, 1990. I found that on an auction site that wasn't eBay, and it was like $100 or something. And I was like, no way am I going to spend $100 for this. They did have a copy of the front cover, and that one was still credited to the same two writers. It had the producer and the director settled by then. And then by November 20th, 1990, which was, if my math is correct, just 3 months later, Dan Gilroy's name is on it. And it seems like he changed quite a few things, which he made Vasendek more friendly. Rather than him killing the cab driver, it ended up being two random Bonejackers that kill this cab driver. And we should probably say that the cab driver doesn't die in the final film. It's got some weird scenes, like when Alex gets the motorcycle, he manages to get it by throwing an egg at the guy who's driving it, and the egg lands between the guy's visor and his face, so he manages to, you know, blind the driver so he can get the motorcycle. The salesman is still there, but Alex gets rid of him by pushing him into a closet in a dance studio. I don't get it. It's like they're in a club, but he pushes them into a closet and locks the door. Then there's an artist character who is in both of the screenplays. She's not in there. There's no Jerry Hall in the script. So I think once they got Mick, as Rob was saying earlier, they got Jerry as well. So they kind of wrote that in there. Of course, you get Emilio's awesome Arnold Schwarzenegger impersonation in the movie, which is always a bonus. And Vasendek is a lot more active in all of these screenplays. He's always out hunting for Furlong, rather than in the final film where he's like at home playing video games and hanging out with the guy with one eye. And then the very last line is so cheesy, it's just unforgivable. When they're kind of done, they ends very much the exact same way as we have in the final film. But we've got Julie and Alex, and they're leaving the McCandless Corporation. In that one, it's called McCandless Ford Daihatsu. So you kind of have more of that Japanese takeover stuff. She says, yesterday, we saved Alex Furlong. Today must be the world.
Oh, mommy, make it stop.
Are you hurting?
I'm hurting. So explain to me again why this movie is like up there, why you think this is so great.
Why do I love this movie?
Yeah, I want to know this.
Everything that I've said, I still love this movie. I love every single time. I guess it's the relationship between Furlong and Vasendek. I really enjoy that. I love every time the Mick Jagger is on screen, even when he's sitting at home playing video games. I really something about it. It just hit all the right notes when it came out, even though while I was watching it, even back in 1992, I'm sitting in the movie theater watching this, and Alex and Julie are in the elevator going up to the whatever-eth floor to meet McCandless. And I'm just like, in my head, 1992, I guess what, I'm 20 years old, and I'm just like, that is the worst blue screen I've ever seen. But I still loved it. I still just got this movie. Fred, what was your reasoning? Why do you still enjoy this movie?
Well, first of all, you hit it I've already mentioned it too, but the relationship between Emilio Estevez and Vicendic. When I think of Free Jack, that is the first thing that comes to my mind. Especially the bridge chase is the one that's the most vivid. That's where the lines are the most fun. The action is just nonstop. That's the crowning moment of the movie in many ways. But it's fun. It's just when I saw it in the theater, everybody was hating it, and I couldn't understand why they were hating it. That tells you a lot right there. I mean, I knew all the pieces that were bad about it. I knew what was structurally wrong with it, but it was fun. I had a good time watching it. And for good or for bad, it seemed like it was trying. Just when this movie could fall into a pit, there's a good actor in there. You know, just when you're thinking, okay, this is really going nowhere, then, you know, they bring back Amanda Plummer and she kicks Jonathan Banks in the groin, you know, and there's these great little moments that keep saving this movie from completely falling over into the abyss. To me, the worst sin a movie can commit is boring you, not entertaining you. Okay. I don't care what kind of film it is. If it doesn't entertain you, that's its worst crime. And this film is dumb. Yes. Tons of mistakes, horrible blue screen, but you do recognize a spark of something in there. It's not like it's completely void of any good ideas. There are some good ideas in there. They're misplaced, but they are there, and there's fun. There's fun characters. There's fun moments. There's fun lines. There's fun chases. I've seen much worse, no doubt.
When people ask me for my guilty pleasure films, I usually go to this and to Hackers. I love both of those movies. I know there's a lot of things that are wrong with both of those movies, but I will watch them. I will put them in the DVD player. I will stop when I'm flipping channels if they happen to be on. I dig these movies, and I am shameless about them. It is one of those where I'm just like, you know what? You can say all the bad things in the world about this film. I will agree with you. But I still enjoy watching it. I hope that it wasn't too bad on you this week, Rob.
No, it wasn't that bad, actually. It was nice to see it because it's one of those that I really loved the trailer. I remember when I was a kid and I saw the trailer in the theater, and I was like, wow, that's an amazing cast. That looks really good. And then I've had like several opportunities to see it over the years, obviously working in a video store and all this and people talking about it, but it never sort of rose to the top of my stack of something that I would go seek out to see. But since I'm forced to pry my eyeballs open like Alex every now and again to watch something that you recommend, as per my contract to be on the projection booth, I didn't hate it, put it that way. I didn't hate it. If I sound like I'm hating on Free Jack, I'm not. I think it's fun. I think it's an entertaining little piece. I just think that overall it's kind of a mess. And as I said before, it doesn't gel the way it should. And you think with so much great talent and all of the things that are sort of surrounding it, that it would be able to hold itself in the container better than it does. That's all really I can say about it.
So with that, we're going to take a little break and play a preview from next week's show.
おじゃけましょ。初めから奥歯に弱み見せたらいけん言うとったでしょ。なるほど。言うわけじゃ。どう。闇宿の仕事になる気の分よ、愛想がないの。何？本当に青じゃい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。うるさい。う って。いい加減にせよ。銭になりませんことしやがって。
そんな気づかせるのもええですけ。
カバンから持っとけ。これはな、今の足にできる精一杯のことじゃ。
土井は死んだと。
これから山盛り組の天下じゃ。堺のてっちゃん帰ってきたし、わしの役目はもう終わった。こんなには悪いが、わしは山盛り組を離れて旅へ出るわ。
兄貴、山盛りを助けたのはあんたじゃけん、堺が帰った言うて関係ないじゃない。今まで通り追ってやって使いや。
有田、山形やったら踊るが。
何の話かやの。
知らんにはの、我んどん出入りしとった場合にちょい、ひらつはやせんと。
かい、ボロ売るんならもちとばしないことせや。やべえ。
If you're fluent in Japanese, you know that was the preview for Battles Without Honor and Humanity. We'll be joined again by Coffin John of the V-Cinema cast next week to talk about this Fukuzaku gangster classic. And if you had a chance to hear the Battle Royale episode, you'll know that our guest on that for the interview was Linda Hoagland, who did the subtitles on many of his films. And she'll be joining us again to talk about Battles Without Honor and Humanity and a little bit. We'll, of course, reference back to that epic Battle Royale episode that we did just recently. I was in the airport in Minneapolis like 2 weeks ago, and the book was there, Battle Royale, the book, right next to the Hunger Games book. It was amazing to see that in an airport bookstore. So there you go. I want to thank this week's guest, Fred Fritz. Fred, what's the latest with Movie Apocalypse?
I'm doing a mini version of Movie Apocalypse to hopefully get some of these out faster. It's called Mini Apocalypse. It'll be out this week. It'll be episode one. It's still set in the Movie Apocalypse universe, and Movie Apocalypse will still come out. But Mini Apocalypse is going to be basically the same great reviews in half the time is the idea. And it's going to be a slightly different take, as I will be in a virtual reality world in this story, The Scavenger. I'll gladly give away the movie this time. It's going to be Sundown, The Vampire in Retreat. It's a personal favorite. I knew I wanted to start off with something. Since it's a genre bender, I thought it'd be kind of fun taking a sci-fi concept of my show and blending it with a comedy western horror film. And I put a lot of work into this monster. It turned out to be 10 times harder than any of the Movie Apocalypse episodes because of the little effects I added.
So not so many.
Not so many as far as the effects. I had to build an intro for this one since it technically is a brand new spinoff of the show. But hopefully future episodes will come out a little quicker. And this show will be more fun. The Movie Apocalypse show is definitely dealing with what I call A-list films that have always had a B or C-list status. That's sort of the goal of that. That's why it's been Road Games and Murder by Decree so far. Whereas with Mini Apocalypse, I'm going to have just films that I love that I think people will love as well. So you're going to have films like Sundown.
Well, we will put a link for it on the Projection Booth website over at projection-booth.com. We'll also be posting about it on our Facebook page, which is facebook.projection-booth.com. If I could add a little bit more dots and dashes, this is going to turn into Morse code. So be sure to come on by, leave us some feedback, and now let the hunt begin.
Free Willy.